Welcome to another edition of the All Souls Forum on KKFI. Today's program features Dr. Rex Archer. He's going to talk about violence seen as an infectious disease. He is the director of the Department of Health for Kansas City, Missouri, and he's one of the experts in the field of how to treat violence. This program was recorded on Sunday, October the 5th at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. We will have our usual format today. We will hear from Dr. Archer, then we will take a break and come back with the questions and answers from the audience. Let's go right to the introduction. Again, you're listening to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI.
Good morning. I'm Linda Vogel-Smith. I'm a member of this church and of the Forum Committee. As many of you know, this is the longest-standing public conversation in Kansas City, having gone on for more than 65 years. So you're a special group to come to this morning, and as I'm sure you do many mornings, Sunday mornings. Today we have a very special speaker whom I've known for 12 years now and worked with, Dr. Rex Archer. And Rex has been here two times before, I believe, and we're really happy to have him back. Dr. Archer is director of the Department of Health of Kansas City, Missouri. And this is an extremely important post because a Department of Health does all the things, many of the things that need to be done every day of the week to keep people healthy. It isn't just it isn't a provider of personal health care services, but it's what you need and what your neighbors need to be healthy. Dr. Archer is going to speak on treating violence like a contagious disease. It's no secret that there is a lot of violence in Missouri and in Kansas City. We contribute our share. We have not made the top 10 states in the nation in terms of violence, but would you believe that Missouri is number 8 in the nation for the incidence of gun violence? It's a very serious issue. So, with that, I'd like to invite Dr. Archer to come to the podium and speak to you.
Well, good morning. I want to apologize in advance. We have ongoing investigation occurring in Kansas City right now, and because of that, I haven't been able to turn off my various alerts, and I may have to even pause during this to at least scan and decide if I need to deal with something immediately or not. As you are aware, from time to time, we have various kinds of issues and challenges, and sometimes they are behaviors as violence that can be contagious, and sometimes they are microorganisms that may potentially spread from person to person. And we're evaluating a case right now that I think is extremely unlikely to end up being a serious issue that we're going to have to deal with. But we always are abundantly cautious on that and want to rule those things out before we make a mistake by not dealing with it the way we should. And in fact, I think it's probably worse since both the group here can spread the word and this will be, I guess, played as a radio broadcast, so people will be hearing this. We need to understand, and I'm going to use the E word in regards to Ebola, that Ebola is not very contagious. Not unlike measles and certain things that we deal with. Measles is an example. If somebody had measles and walked through this room itself, even an hour and a half to 2 hours before the rest of you came in, If any of you were not immunized and did not have protection, you could catch the measles just from breathing the air an hour and a half, 2 hours later. Ebola is not that way. Ebola is not spread in the air that way. You can walk by somebody with Ebola and you're still not at high risk of exposure. And the other thing that's different between measles and Ebola, as an example, is with measles, we can spread the disease for several days before we even know we're ill. And that's the reason why we actually do have to quarantine folks with measles to keep the spread from occurring, because some folks either can't get immunity with the immunizations or their immune systems are compromised, or small infants that aren't old enough to be immunized yet can be exposed. And so that's why we create the ring immunity with measles vaccination, but we also may have to quarantine somebody. We do have a national problem in that area. We do not have required sick leave or isolation leave, which we should have as a country to protect our citizens, because we've had cases when we were dealing with the measles outbreak here in Kansas City where the folks now can't work, but they don't get paid sick leave, and now they can't make their rent payments. Their landlord's thinking about ejecting them when we're trying to keep them quarantined. We're having to bring food to them, because obviously they can't go out and buy food in a grocery store if they even had the money, because they're now not able to work. So there are some national issues in that area that we should be addressing. The difference with Ebola is, though, that we isolate people that are ill that are contagious, and Ebola doesn't spread until you actually are ill and have symptoms. So that gives us a lot more time to deal with that issue. So having said that, let's move on, if we can have the next slide. And I guess one last comment. The reason we have government is to solve problems collectively that we can't do individually. And sometimes we forget that. Let me back up to another example. We talk a lot about individual responsibility in this country. And if I tell you, and all other credible sources tell you, that it's important to drink safe water, and therefore all water needs to be safe, and one way to make it safe would be to boil it, correct? So I'm going to hold everybody individually responsible for boiling your own water. We're no longer going to provide public water that's sanitized because, you know, individuals should be responsible. But that's sometimes the way that we look at other issues. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. This is a picture back in the Middle Ages. Infectious diseases were a challenge then. We didn't understand a lot of the etiology. They could spread pretty rapidly through cities, whether it's the Black Death or whatever that outbreak might be. Next slide. And so we have a long history in public health with leprosy, smallpox, cholera, yellow fever, other types of contagious or infectious diseases that we often held the individual responsible for instead of understanding what our collective responsibility might be. Well, one approach is to lock the person up, to blame the individual for whatever they have, if it's an infectious disease, or, dare I say, a violent behavior, and we lock them up. Next slide. And so one of the things that I want you to think about, in some ways, what I'm going to be talking about today is just as challenging for us as Americans as what it would have been like back in the Middle Ages when everybody assumed that the earth was flat. If somebody tried to talk to us as a group about why the earth was not flat. And you can imagine the resistance when our narrative, our dominant idea of looking at something is a particular way, it takes a lot of evidence to break us out of that paradigm. And so there is the punishment theory, the idea that the way that we stop bad behavior or violence is by punishing people, often violently. Interesting paradox there. Or the everything theory. Next slide. Under the everything theory, you have dysfunctional communities, poverty, poor schools, family disorders, racism, absent fathers, broken homes, lead poisoning, all kinds of things going on out there. And yes, we have a lot of that in Kansas City, and it is often more prevalent in the areas that we have higher levels of violence. But we also have all of these conditions in other parts of the world where they don't have our level of violence. Next slide. So we actually have a new understanding. Click again there. And this is our scientific understanding. Click again. And what we've learned is that we have new methods to control communicable disease. We can do early detection. We can do case finding. We can do new categories of workers and new systems of disease control. But we can do this for violence in the same way that we would do it for a bacteria or a virus. Next slide. Click again. So if we think about violence as a contagious disease, next. This is the definition in Dorland's Medical Dictionary. Contagious just means it's able to be transmitted. Next slide. And it's transmitted from person to person. Next. This shows you the risk in regards to transmission of people living in housing area. These are similar housing projects, but in those where violence is high and people are much more exposed to violence than in other housing projects where violence is low, the chances that they then will commit violence themselves are much lower. And you can see, though, that the folks that are in the higher exposure areas, violence goes up 30 times. All other conditions are basically the same between these two groups, other than how much exposure do they have of violence. Next slide. Let's move to the next one here. So then, if we look at the definition of disease, it's any deviation from or interruption from the normal structure or function. Next slide. So if we look at violence as a contagious disease, there are population characteristics, and there are three of those: clustering, epidemic waves, and transmission. So we'll talk about each of these three. So if we have cholera in Bangladesh, you can see the clustering that's occurring of the cases of cholera. And you would expect that, since cholera goes in through the mouth, grows in the body, comes out, pollutes the general area around somebody, and then the next person can catch that. So you'll see clustering occur with a contagious disease process. Next slide. This is clustering of violence in Chicago. You can see the same kind of clustering patterns. Next. Cholera. You'll have an epidemic wave. Here you'll see the wave of cholera, and often you get one spike and then a smaller secondary spike. You'll get these waves. Next. This is violence in Rwanda. Again, you'll see these spikes. If you remember, with the World War I, we start with the assassination of the Archduke. So you've got one violent act of assassination. And then we're going to click through these and watch this spread. Well, actually, I guess I hit all those slides. So unfortunately, what would have happened is you would have seen it go from one country to the next country to the next country, and just spread like wildfire across the whole population. Next slide. Eventually, we had 15 to 20 million people dead from that violence outbreak. I had a problem. My PowerPoint didn't load correctly, so I had to use a different one, and so a couple of these slides are a little different. You'll see transmission here from influenza, from exposure moving through the person to the next person. Next. Colds are the same way. Next. TB is the same way. Next. Violence is the same way. Actually spreads from person to person. Next. So here's an example across syndromes. So if somebody observes violence in the community, they are more likely to be a participant, a victim, and observe violence in the community. They're also more likely to be a victim or observe family or interpartner violence. And they're more likely, by observing violence in the community, to commit suicide themselves and become a victim. Next slide. Here's a case where a child observes violence between the child's parents. They are more likely to actually do child abuse themselves as a parent, or spouse abuse themselves, or community violence. So you actually get all three of these occur from that. With child abuse, if you're a victim of child abuse, and most people would think, well, boy, if you were a victim of child abuse, you would know how bad that was, and the last thing you would want to do is do it to your own children. But actually, if you were a victim of child abuse, your odds of victimizing your own children go way up. You're also more likely to commit violence to your partner. Next slide. War. Violence between countries. People that observe it or are victims of violence or participate in the violence are more likely to commit community violence, to commit intimate partner violence, to commit child abuse. So our wars are actually spreading and causing a lot of our violence in our societies. So this violence transmits across all of these syndromes. And in the past, if we were thinking that child abuse was different from homicides in the community, was different from intimate partner violence, they're actually being caused by each other. Next slide. So let's move on to transmission a little bit more on the means. And again, if it goes from person to person, you'll see with cholera, we talked about this. Cholera goes in through the mouth. It increases in the body and then goes out and spreads to other people. Next slide. Here you'll see violence goes in through our eyes, actually changes the neural pathways. We can actually measure changes in the brain when exposed to violence and the way that the pathways of the brain work or don't work. So there's a processing that goes on. And unfortunately then, the threshold or the opportunity that that individual will then spread the violence goes way up. Next slide. So there was a fantastic workshop back in the fall of 2012 under the Institute of Medicine. And if you're familiar, National Academies of Sciences is like 150 years old. Our health department started about the same time, 148 years ago, and 2 years we'll be having our 150th anniversary. But the National Academy of Sciences was set up by Congress to actually look at the science and not let partisan politics interfere with at least the science assessment of an issue. And the Institute of Medicine is a subgroup of that National Institute of Medicine is a subgroup of the National Academy of Sciences. So they did this great workshop on the contagion of violence. We have what are called mirror neurons. A lot of our learning is through watching, whether it's sports, whether it's children mimicking adults. We pick up these things all the time. And when we notice and watch violence, we tend to have similar learning processes. And you'll see how rage can be developing when parts of the brain are activated. Next. So, the more exposures you have in a community, the more observations, and you get this cycle of violence. So, in Missouri, we actually have often the highest black homicide rates in the country, because those are the communities that a lot of our violence is in right now. They're observing it the most. They're struggling with it the most because of that observation, and we have to break that cycle. Next slide. Well, it turns out we know how to reverse epidemics, whether that's the CDC, the World Health Organization, our Kansas City Health Department, public health in general. Many of you may be aware that we were the first voluntarily accredited health department in the nation back in June of 2004, and we've developed national standards now. We're one of the first 19 health departments to become accredited nationally, and tied with Chicago as the first two city health departments to become nationally accredited. And part of that accreditation standards is, can you document that you understand what are epidemics about, and how do you stop them? How do you reverse them? Next slide. So we stop epidemics basically three ways. We interrupt the transmission between people. Half of our homicides most years, at least, are retaliations. We prevent the spread, and we change group norms. So interrupting transmission, we just kind of click through this, and you can kind of see how when one person gets angry and passes this on to the other. We have a hospital intervention program. Obviously, when somebody has been shot or stabbed and is in the emergency room, they may be, if they're conscious, thinking about what? Retaliation, revenge. And if they're not, family and friends probably are. So we're deployed to Truman Medical Center. The ER nurses immediately call us. Our staff go in and start working with folks to change that thinking and processing. Next slide. Let's kind of keep flipping through that. Okay. So we have to identify who also is high risk in a community. Who is most likely to be shot or shoot? So it's not just waiting till they end up in the emergency room. We actually have folks on the street in communities and are often there before somebody would call the police department, because we see things starting to escalate on Facebook or various other ways that we're hearing in the community, that people are starting to get more and more angry, and we get there to interrupt and intervene. The program is called Aim for Peace that we run in the health department. Next. Let's flip through a couple of these. Okay, so most of you are aware that one of the developments that humans have over other mammals is a more developed prefrontal cortex. That has the capacity to override our limbic part of our brains, or what's called the amygdala. The amygdala is part of the body that is through a lot of different animals because it was part of that fight or flight response. It was a survival mechanism to gear up and kind of hit with adrenaline and either run fast or fight to try to survive. Now, it turns out that the prefrontal cortex can override and keep that amygdala under control if it's well trained. But it's not fully mature in humans until age 24. So even up to that range, it's not fully developed in regards to its capacity. And that's only if there's adequate training. Next slide. So it turns out that sometimes, particularly, unfortunately, if any of us are getting angry, and some of you may either know this yourself or know it with people you know, they can get to a point where they're not thinking up here anymore, they're reacting. And that's where we have to then become the frontal lobe for the other individual. One of the best ways to help a person get control and center themselves again actually turns out to be through asking questions. If you just ask a yes or no question, that's too easy to answer. They don't have to go into their frontal lobe very long to answer the question. Now, we also know it's possible to beat people up with questions and to be asking questions for the wrong reason that may aggravate them. So you do have to be careful the type of question. But I'll give you an example. In the emergency room, somebody's been shot. Other folks around them that are there are getting angrier and angrier over the situation. Now you start asking, well, did the person that got shot, did they have some other responsibility? Did they need to be picking up a kid? Or was there something else that needs to be done that we need to do for that person now to be helping out? And then that gets people starting to think about other things. It ratchets it down. Same thing when you're having a political discussion. I mean, sometimes I open this talk with what my dad used to warn me about when I was growing up. He'd say, son, there's three things you don't talk about in public or polite conversation, is the way he used to say it. Sex, politics, and religion. And little did he know I was going to become a health officer and have to talk about all three all the time. But how you talk about it matters. And how you ask questions, and are you trying to win an argument with somebody, or are you trying to understand where they are and help them think things through? Because if they move into their amygdala, they're not listening or learning anymore, or potentially transforming or changing. They're moving back into an area that's not going to be very helpful. Next slide. So it actually turns out that through these techniques, we can change our neural pathways. In fact, one of the best methods is meditation or contemplation. Folks that do contemplation strengthen the connection between their frontal lobe and their amygdala. There are more fibers going. They can manage anger better. I struggle with contemplation meditation. I'll just have to confess to the group. And I work on it for a while, and then I slip to the side. I'm not doing it like I know I want to or should. One of the interesting things is when I start back up again, for the first few weeks, what I will notice is I am angrier. Now, when I talk to my friends, my wife, she says, well, you're not any angrier, you just know it now. So there is an early phase of that process where you're just becoming aware that you were angry and didn't even know it. It's interesting. Also, contemplation or meditation actually changes how we view a higher being. If we have a belief in any type of a spiritual or higher being, that type of being changes as we do contemplation and meditation. We move from a strict, authoritative, punishing type of being that is judgmental to one that is more caring and benevolent and supportive and nurturing. It's very interesting. Next. So, but for this to happen, we have to be credible messengers. So a lot of our folks that we hire in our violence prevention programs have unfortunately made mistakes in the past and committed violent acts and may have served time for that, but have found that not only do they want to change, but they probably feel that part of the reason that they ended up where they were was to help prevent others from going down the same road. And so those are the folks that we hire to get out there that do this work. Next slide. But they have to have that credibility in the community. In many of those areas, I would have absolutely no credibility. I could not possibly go in and really effectively help and really even understand what those folks are going through in that community. Next. So we interrupt transmission. We prevent future spread, and then we change community norms. Now, let me give you an example of a community norm change. When folks call our Aim for Peace out because things are getting agitated at an event, it's actually interesting now when Aim for Peace shows up, you see this almost collective sigh. All the folks were wanting to get better control. They're not wanting to commit this violence really in their heart of hearts. And you see a group relaxation and a kind of feeling like, okay, we can get this under control. We don't need to go that next step. One of the best examples actually came out of another city. I expect we'll have one of these in our city eventually. Is that, let's say a community norm has changed on violence, but the person has been in jail the last 10 years and now gets out on probation and comes back to that community. And they're in a bar, and things are escalating, and they pull out a gun. And everybody in the bar looks at them like, we don't do that. And the group pressure, they put the gun away. Because everybody, I mean, group pressure can be very painful when people actually kind of look at you. I mean, think about smoking. Think of how that's changed for people that smoke still. But if they smoke in a place that the group pressure would say, no, we don't expose people to tobacco smoke in this setting anymore, they immediately get that feeling if they forget and start to light up. The same thing can happen with violence as we change the group norm. Next slide. So even when we have susceptible people, we actually teach violence in our prisons. This process of stopping violence and this program that we're doing here that we have adapted from Chicago is now actually being tried in some prisons in England. To actually stop violence from being taught in prison, folks that go into prison that aren't violent are likely to become violent after they're in prison. So our prisons, and we put more people in prison than any other country in the world per capita, we're teaching and we have an epidemic of violence growing from our prisons in this country. It's part of our problem, actually. Next slide. So we map. We look at all of the various kinds of violence in our community and our hot zones. Next. And we have new categories of workers. I don't think I've ever had to give a talk when I've had to watch all these kinds of issues going on with the media right now. So we interrupt, and there's a skill set to doing this. You have to listen and connect with the other person. If you're too preachy. They're a whole skill set with interrupting violence. Next slide. And this is really cutting edge. These are new healthcare workers, every bit as important as nurses and doctors. Next. And as I mentioned, we do hospital interventions. Next. So we interrupt transmission, we prevent future transmission, and then we are behavioral change agents. And so a lot of our folks that are most likely to do violent acts have not had stable relationships with two parents, and often it's the male that is missing in various ways. And unfortunately, a lot of those things were things that at times we may have thought we were doing good, but we created other problems as a society, etc. But what part of this program is about is creating better mentors and helping the high-risk kids learn from folks that can manage their behavior in a new and different and better way. Next slide. So they're trained on all these things. It takes several years before our outreach workers are really up to optimum. It's not something that even in the first year they're in full capacity to do this work. It's intensive training. Just as you wouldn't imagine that a clinical psychologist or a psychiatrist could just get this all down in a few months. Next. This just gives some of the training issues that we do with our staff. Next slide. Let's go through a couple of these fairly quickly here. So we have all these types of interveners, clergy, police. Police supports this program. We actually get funding from the police department to put more of these folks out on the street. There's not communication going back and forth because the folks on the street would not trust our folks if they were, quote, talking to the police about what's going on. We're at the time to wrap up a little bit.
Yeah,
okay.
And then we'll do Q&A.
Okay, Q&A. Let's flip through real quickly here. Just keep going. Let's talk about results here. You'll see the huge reductions in homicides. Keep going. All these different studies that have been done, we'll just kind of flip through these slides, and you'll see huge reductions in violence in these communities. Just keep going. 100% reductions in 5 out of the 8 in this study. Next slide. This is independent by the Department of Justice, and you'll see the huge reductions in shootings. Keep flipping through. Let's just go all the way to the end here. Okay, stop. Yeah, back up one. So the old view was bad people or enemies need to be punished. The new view is this is a contagious behavior, and we have to unlearn the behavior and interrupt it. Just as we would not blame somebody for cholera or Ebola or measles, we shouldn't be blaming people for violence and thinking that violent punishment is going to stop it, because it actually doesn't. Next. Let's keep going here. That's what happens when you have the wrong diagnosis. Next. Let's stop right there. Okay. In Kansas City, as you know, we've had about a 33% reduction in homicides this year. But in the zones that we're in with Aim for Peace, because we don't have enough staff to do the whole city, we've had an 80% reduction in homicides in those zones. So with that, let's open for questions.
Listening to Dr. Rex Archer, and he's talking about violence today on the All Souls Forum. He is the director of the Department of Health in Kansas City. We owe you some messages. Let's go take them right now, and we'll be right back with the second part of our program today. You're listening to the All Souls Forum on KKFI.
To come here for where a place where there has not been a Panther reunion. I've been to reunions in the Bay Area, in Washington, in Atlanta, and even Chicago. But nothing here. And so this is the beginning, and it's extraordinary. It's a lot of work, so congratulations. Yes. Thank you. And thank you for bringing Tanzania here. Yes. Thank you.
a panel discussion, Women of the Black Panther Party, on Tell Somebody, 9 a.m. Thursday.
The Grassroots Radio Conference took place in Ames, Iowa this summer. Folks came from community radio stations all across the country. Hear some of those voices on Sprouts, Thursday at noon.
This week on Music City Roots, live from the factory, the old school and the new school in bluegrass music, as we hear from beloved traditionalists Joe Mullins and the Radio Ramblers, as well as Telluride Band Contest winners Front Country.
Feel the roots shake, hear my heart break. I'm in love with the sound. I'm in love with the sound. The love that we make.
We're also going to enjoy deep and stirring songwriting from Jeff Black and the Native American crossover music of Gareth Laffley. Also, an archival bonus set from Minnesota's brilliant young John Mark Nelson. It's just another night of handmade roots music from the factory floor in Franklin, Tennessee. Music City Roots.
Saturday morning at 7, right before the Blues Kitchen.
LGBTQIA, 1 p.m. on Saturday, music, news, and interviews. This is what you ought to do. Tune to 90.1 FM, Saturdays at 1 p.m.
The 10th Voice, because you refuse to be silent.
I know this group is good at questions, so somebody jump up there.
Could you tell us, please, your view of how violence in television, movies, other media contributes to the contagious nature of violence? And then be specific if some types do and some types don't in the media?
Just as with various kinds of communicable diseases, it depends on the level of exposure or risk on the likelihood that somebody will get that disease. If you spend a full 8 hours sitting next to somebody in a car that's coughing the whole time on you while they're speaking, that's a different level of exposure than if you are in an elevator with them for one floor, or you walk by them in the hallway and they cough once. So violence is the same way. When we actually participate in it ourselves, so we're doing it to somebody else, or having it done directly to us, that's the highest risk. When we observe it being done to somebody that we personally know, that's very close to that risk. At each level down from that, it's less risky, but it does add up and it's cumulative. So if you get enough of the other exposures, it can still be pretty significant. So even when you get to watching it on TV, if it's a homicide in your neighborhood, even if you didn't know that person, that's worse than if it's a homicide in another city or another country. But yes, video games, although they are, or even Saturday morning cartoons, can be pretty darn violent. And the younger the person is, the less they're able to separate that from reality also. But is the main way to stop violence through those video games? Probably that's not the most important. Does it help watching those things? No. There's a lot of other things that probably aren't good that are being learned through that kind of stuff. But yes, when we see it vicariously, we can learn from just observing it even on the media. Yes.
My question deals more with, I think it's called the prison industrial complex, and the idea that a lot of people are making money off violence. And I'm wondering, do you get pushback from the people that violence has become a profitable industry?
Many of the biggest challenges we have in this country are challenges because somebody someplace is making a lot of money off of that issue and is fighting moving things forward. You know, Eisenhower, even in his speech, was going to talk about the military-industrial complex, but he was actually going to include legislature, so it was the military-congressional-industrial complex, and he dropped it out of his speech. So, the fact that we can have a war and have and not have a war windfall profits tax, why should companies make the kind of money they make selling these weapons to both sides in many cases? When I worked for Ford Motor Company for a number of years and they sent me over to do some consulting work in England, Germany, and Spain, I was with one of the German Ford doctors, and I noticed that a lot of the beautiful churches and older historical buildings didn't exist in Cologne any place except for next to the Ford plant. Well, it turned out that Ford was making money on both sides, creating vehicles for both sides, and had agreements with both countries not to bomb close to his plants. Yes, that's part of it. It's a big concern. Weaning ourselves off of thinking that locking people up is the answer, it just isn't.
I guess there are a lot of people familiar with behavioral psychology. B.F. Skinner did some studies. For example, you take two groups of, subjects. One group, when they misbehave, they're punished. But if they behave properly, whatever, in the desired way, they're ignored. The other group, when they did the desired behavior, they were rewarded, but when they did the undesirable behavior, they weren't punished. And they found that positive reinforcement for positive behavior is a lot more effective shaper of behavior than is negative punishment for undesirable behavior. I was wondering if you might care to comment on that.
I think you laid it up very nicely. That's where the research is. And to carry it even farther, the research isn't just in humans. And sometimes we like to get into this nature-nurture thing over genetics, and maybe our genes are causing this. Well, it turns out that if you study rats as an example, rat mothers will raise a different litter. If you swap the litters, they'll go ahead and raise another rat's litter, and that mother will raise the other litter if you swap them on them. Well, there are types of mother rats that are more nurturing, and there is some genetic tendency on that, where they were more likely to lick and groom their offspring. But it turns out that if you flip the two groups, the rats that didn't have that genetic tendency but were raised by the mothers that licked and groomed developed that ability, and their genetics are actually modified. There's a modification process called epigenetics that actually changes the way their genes end up being expressed. And they will then be nurturing. And the rats that weren't nurtured are the other way. We're moving more and more, Children's Mercy Hospital, others here in the metro area, our health department, on what are called ACEs, adverse childhood events. And these things predict how long we live, a whole lot of issues. Helping a way of stopping this and helping parents cope better. You know, we have challenges now because of lack of living wage and a lot of other things where parents aren't able to be parents because they can't be home or they're exhausted when they are home. That wasn't there when most of us in this room were growing up, when we had very different social and economic situations. But when you have the accumulation of wealth at the top and the hardships that are occurring with everybody else, it does challenge us. Next question.
A lot of our veterans face the same issues that prisoners do with regards to being exposed to a culture of conflict. And many veterans also face real health issues such as post-traumatic stress disorder. What can we do to help them in a similar way from being exposed to violence when they reintegrate into society and become so that they aren't so sick when they come back?
I would actually argue that there's almost nobody in this country that doesn't have post-traumatic stress syndrome. That we all view and see too much violence. Now, some have it much worse than others. I'm not saying that they don't. And our veterans clearly are exposed at very high levels. Part of that high suicide rate that's occurring in veterans is, again, if you remember when I was showing those different slides of the syndrome issues, they turn that aggression and violence on themselves because of their exposure to the violence in their other positions, in a sense, when they were in the conflict. So, once you start going down that road of saying our spiritual leaders that have talked about nonviolence, most of us don't like to really say that, well, we believe in them, but maybe not on that. It's interesting. For the first 300 years, most historians believe that people did not believe they could be Christian and even be in the military after Jesus' crucifixion. So it's an interesting challenge that I think we've got a lot of dialogue over. I certainly don't have the answer, but I do think we need to talk about it a lot more. Yes.
Yeah, you talked a little bit just now about what Children's Mercy does. I know that, and you mentioned the other issues that affect violence, poverty, poor parenting, the economy, all of that. Is the health department working with anybody else to address some of those issues, which are separate from the prefrontal cortex?
Absolutely. We partner with both CCO, Communities Creating Opportunity, and Moore Square, Metropolitan Organization for Racial and Economic Equity, of which this congregation is an active member of, and working on the living wages and predatory lending, the success we had of, you know, it used to be that felons, people who had previously served their time, came out, but if they had a drug-related charge, could not get SNAP or food stamps even for their family. We got that changed, and that was a bipartisan effort, so that was good. Ban the Box, both Moore Squared and CCO and others came together to remove that. When somebody's applying for a position in the city, as an example, and a supervisor is very busy and they get 150 folks on the list of eligible people, well, they don't have time to interview 150 people, so they were sorting, and one of the ways they'd sort is if that box said that they were a felon, then they never even interviewed them. So we took that off that form. Now this way they can get all the way through the process, and then after they've had their interviews, then it's checked, because obviously if they happen to have been a pedophile, we would not want them working with kids. But for most cases, their felony charge has nothing to do with the type of work that they would be doing in the city and shouldn't have been an exclusion. But if they can't get back to work, they can't enter back into society and be part of that process. So a lot of those changes are very important. But I do want to say one thing. Unless we get violence down and under control, almost none of those other things will work. You're not going to get employers to move back into an area when there's high violence. Kids are not going to learn in the schools if there's an empty seat because their classmate was killed. The psychology is not the same there. So for anything else to be fixed, we have to bring the violence down. And we can bring the violence down without actually fixing any of those other things yet. then we'll have more resources, though, to fix them, too.
Thank you.
The next two questions will be the last, and they need to be relatively brief.
And the answer's brief, too.
There's a lot of observation that our criminal justice system and law enforcement agencies are a really high portion of the problem, if you will, in terms of the transmission of violence. And with so many law enforcement agencies being such a poor reflection of communities that they're serving, that seems to be a part of the problem as well. I was curious as to whether you mentioned that law enforcement and the police departments have been involved in this work that you're doing. I was curious as to how receptive they've been to this reframing, and also how important do you think it is that we reposition what the role is of law enforcement in the communities as an important part of, you know, because if you think about who would be attracted to being a police officer, it seems like it would be the exact opposite of the type of impact or influence you'd want to have if you're thinking of breaking this cycle of a transmission of violence.
Well, obviously, Chief Forte is very concerned about these issues and is leading changes within an organization. And a big organization doesn't change 100% in 1 hour or 1 day, but it's moving in the right direction. Their community policing, the officers being more known in the community, and you've probably seen the footage with them out playing basketball or other things with folks in the community. I don't think any of that was going on in Ferguson. You know, that there is a different approach that is slowly changing. Is it as fast as any of us would like? No, but I do think we're headed in a better direction here and not as overreacting. I think all your comments are very valid, and we do need to continue to work on those. Yes.
Thanks for coming. Do you see any application of your approach to the beheading violence of ISIS and the crimes against women in those communities?
Violence is violence. Ironically, the more that we talk about it and show it, in many ways, the more that it's going to occur and the more we focus on it. You know, many of you may have been watching the PBS series on the Roosevelts, all three of them, and their leadership and their strengths and weaknesses, and at times, at least a couple of them, being fairly violent, but other times seeming to understand some of this. It is very, very difficult to turn the other cheek. It does not mean that we don't nonviolently resist. But if, you know, one of my favorite movies of all time is movie Gandhi, because it really shows you that, yes, people can suffer, but there is a point where if most people in that country refuse to participate in the oppression, the people at the top really can't lead that country anymore. But when we go in and demonstrate violence to remove this or that violent person, in a sense, violence never wins. It may temporarily look like it won, but then the conclusion is, well, violence worked here, then we can use violence because it works. And it actually really never does.
You just heard Dr. Rex Archer, who is the director of the Department of Health in Kansas City, Missouri. He's been talking about violence and treating it as you would an infectious disease. This program was recorded on Sunday, October 5th at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. Each week, this show is produced by Barry Lee and edited by him as well. Thank you to Vita Norton and the staff at All Souls for their help in producing this program. Your theme song, composed and played by Kansas City musician Fred Potter. Join us again next week for another All Souls Forum right here on KKFI. You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.